Welcome to Inside Medical Malpractice. My name is Chris Rokosch. I'm a registered nurse, legal consultant and educator, and the president of Connect Medical Legal Experts. Each month, we'll be looking at the malpractice issues from different perspectives, featuring honest, candid, insightful interviews by people and professionals with a wealth of information to share. Thanks for spending time with me today. Now let's dive into this fascinating subject. Welcome to a very special episode of Inside Medical Malpractice. I'm going to open this podcast today by introducing the speaker first, and then tell you what we're going to talk about because we have a fascinating issue that I'm so looking forward to discussing. My guest today is Duncan Emery. He's a partner and head of the malpractice group at Ninestein Personal Injury Lawyers. He primarily acts on behalf of plaintiffs on cases involving medical negligence and for plaintiffs in all types of catastrophic personal injury claims. He also handles complex multi-jurisdictional cases. Duncan has acted on behalf of the Office of the Children's Lawyer, provides co-counsel assistance to other lawyers in handling complex negligence cases at both trial and appeal. I've heard Duncan speak a few times in my life. He's a regular speaker and presenter in the area of medical negligence for the Ontario Trialers Association, the Ontario Bar Association, the Law Society of Upper Canada, and many other places. He's been voted by his peers as a leading expert in his field since 2014 in the Canadian Lexpert Directory. He's also been named as one of Canada's best lawyers since 2015 and certified as a specialist in civil litigation by the Law Society of Upper Canada. Duncan has been involved recently in a malpractice case in Ontario that has sparked great debate over whether a fertility doctor owes a duty of care to not only the woman who's undergoing the fertility treatments, but to her future children, should they become injured during the course of conception, pregnancy, or perhaps birth. Proving that a doctor owes a duty of care to his or her patient is one of the fundamental pieces of any malpractice case. There's a duty of care, there's the defining the breach in the standard of care, there's establishing that there was an injury, and there's the ever-present causation issue of proving that the breach in the standard of care caused or contributed to the outcome. If any one of these pieces of the pie cannot be proven, the case may not or will not be successful. Fertility treatments are fascinating right now because they are new, relatively, since the 70s. But they have emerged as both an incredibly popular and one of the most successful medical technologies in the past century. Artificial insemination first grew in significant popularity, as I said, in the 70s. The first so-called test tube baby, or IVF baby, was Louise Brown. She was born in 1978, which is, at the time of this recording, is 44 years ago. But the growth has been significant because currently IVF accounts for approximately 1% of all live births in the United States. And around the world, millions of children have been conceived and born thanks to the use of fertility medicines. New issues are constantly emerging, and the courts and legislation are being asked to address brand new ethical, legal, and social questions. Today, with Duncan Emery, we're going to talk about one of those cases. In 2007, a 26-year-old woman named Dana Florence was prescribed a fertility drug called Seraphine, or Clomiphene. It's a medication which increases ovulation. It was prescribed by gynecologist Dr. Susan Benzequin. A known side effect of Seraphine is its increased risk of multiple births. Between 5 and 12% of women will become pregnant with twins or triplets, depending on which research you look at. And in this particular case, within weeks of starting the fertility drug, Dana was diagnosed with triplets at 11 weeks gestation. As very often happens with triplets and multiple pregnancies, the threat of preterm labor was very real and present by the time she was approximately 20 weeks pregnant. The triplets were then born, one girl, two boys, weighing between just about 1.5 pounds and just over 2 pounds, were born by cesarean section on New Year's Day in 2008 at approximately 26 weeks gestation, which is more than 3 months early. They have since that time been diagnosed with moderate to severe cerebral palsy and significant neurological impairment. Two of the issues in this case
are, does the doctor owe a duty of care to a patient who does not yet exist? As in, did the doctor who prescribed the fertility drug owe a duty or any responsibility to the outcome for the health of these babies? And the other one we're going to discuss today, as I hear it from Duncan, is one of consent. Was Dana properly advised of the risk of conceiving twins or triplets, the associated risk of multiple pregnancies that come along with fertility drugs, which include preterm birth and the risk of neurological and developmental injury, and if she had known about these risks, would she have taken this medication? So let's rip into this fascinating issue. Duncan, I have to tell you, I'm finding this popping up in articles and blogs and on LinkedIn and magazines all across the country right now. I had dinner with a couple of lawyers here in Florida a couple of weeks ago, and it was hot on the, because that's where I happen to be spending my winter months this year, and it was a hot topic of discussion between some lawyers and a judge. And Duncan's representing Dana Florence and her triplets in the Ontario courts, the Court of Appeal, and ultimately at the Supreme Court. So welcome, Duncan. I am so happy you're here.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here, and I'm happy to talk about this issue because I think it is one that definitely deserves some discussion.
I agree. I think lots of people are going to be fascinated by this discussion today. So I've offered what I hope is a brief but accurate overview of the case issues, but I'm sure there is so much more to this story. Why don't you tell it from your version? Tell us about the case Florence versus the Benzequin.
Well, I think your introduction to it is largely right. I mean, the claim was started in 2011 against the factual backdrop that you'd mentioned in terms of Dana having been prescribed fertility medication. She was 26 years old when that happened, and her and her husband had been trying for a very short time to start a family, which is one of the issues that's going forward in the case in terms of whether or not in those circumstances it was appropriate or indicated to prescribe fertility medication in the first place. The result of that prescription of fertility medication is, as you've alluded to, Dana did become pregnant with triplets very quickly, and despite the best medical care available at the time, she went into preterm labor, and the children were delivered just short of 26 weeks gestation at a time which is obviously very, very fragile and on the cusp of viability. And as a result of the prematurity of their delivery, all three of the triplets suffered varying degrees of cerebral palsy, neurologic injuries. Now, they are wonderful children. They've made incredible gains, and thanks in large part to their parents and their care support systems, they've done incredibly well. But they've been left with real challenges, challenges that affect their development and affect their needs going forward, their need for support to live as normal and independent and free a life as we would all expect and want for our children. And that's the genesis or the basis underlying the claims. So in 2011, the action was started against the gynecologist, Dr. Benzequin, who prescribed the fertility medication. And it was started on behalf of Dana Florence and her husband, Jared. It was also, though, started on behalf of the three children on the basis that they, too, were owed a duty of care, even though they weren't conceived or obviously born at the time of the alleged negligence. Because fertility medication, while it's generally quite a safe medication, it does carry risks like all medication does. And those risks have to be weighed against the circumstances and the benefits involved. And in a situation like this, the allegation is that the medication was contraindicated to Dana Florence because she was 26 years old and had been trying for a very short time, and therefore, you know, medication shouldn't have been started for her, and that exposed both her and her unborn and at that time unconceived children to risk of harm that, of course, then developed. So that sort of frames why the case started and what it's about. And I think what's really important to understand, because I get a lot of people calling me or asking me about, how can, isn't it like saying the children would be better off not having been born at all? And that's not the basis of this claim. And I think it's really important to draw that distinction early on. The claim is these children now have real and substantial care needs that arose because of the act of another. And those care needs need to be met. And the question is, should they be compensable at the hands of the person who we allege caused those needs to exist, or should they not?
That's a great breakdown of the story, and it's such a fascinating story to me. As you know, my background is in obstetrical nursing, and the issue of whether or not the unborn and certainly not and the unconceived now have rights has always been an issue in my line of work and my day-to-day line of work. Tell us about the journey going through the courts that's happened to date and where you're going to take this case from here.
Yeah, so it's had a lengthy history, as you can sort of tell, given that it was started in 2011, and it went through a lot of the regular pretrial steps in terms of examinations for discovery and exchange of expert reports and records and those sorts of issues. And the case was actually scheduled for trial about a year or just over a year ago now. And shortly before the trial was due to start, the defendant physician, through her lawyers, brought a motion to strike the claims of the children under a rule in Ontario called Rule 21, which is a motion to strike on a base of law. So no evidence on the motion, but simply an argument that as a matter of law, no duty of care could be found to be owed to the children, and therefore their claims should not be the subject of a trial. And that was argued in front of a very senior and experienced judge in Toronto, who sided with the defendant physician and ruled that no duty of care could be owed to the children, and therefore their claims were dismissed or struck without the right to proceed the trial, as I say, solely on the basis that they could not be owed a duty of care. We, needless to say, did not agree with that decision, and we appealed it to the Court of Appeal for Ontario, and that was argued in the spring of 2021, I guess. And after full argument, the court reserved its decision for a period of time, and it released a decision. So in the Court of Appeal, it's a three-member panel that hears an appeal like this, and the Court of Appeal decision was a 2-1 decision upholding the motion judge's decision. So two of the justices at the Court of Appeal agreed that no duty of care could be found to be owed to the Florence triplets, and therefore the claim was properly dismissed at the motions level. There was a lengthy dissent written by Justice Fairburn, who's the Associate Chief Justice of the Province of Ontario, who set out, very much followed the argument we were making to the court, which I'm happy to, and I'm sure we will get into in a little greater detail today. Suffice it to say, Justice Fairburn's conclusion was that you couldn't determine that in all circumstances, no duty could be owed to a child who was born with disabilities, but where the alleged negligence occurred before conception, and therefore that it should be decided on a full trial record after trial. Given that it was a 2-1 decision, we then sought leave to appeal that decision to the Supreme Court of Canada, because there is no automatic appellate right to the Supreme Court of Canada. One needs a leave of that court to bring an appeal. We filed a lengthy memorandum of argument with the court, and a couple of months ago now, or I guess about a month ago now, the Supreme Court released its decision, which was not to grant leave, which means that the case will not be heard by the Supreme Court of Canada. And sadly, the rights of the Florence triplets are at an end. There is no legal basis now for them to move forward with the allegation or argument that they can and should be found to be owed a duty of care in these specific circumstances.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of questions about what you just said there. When you said the Court of Appeals said there could not be rights of the unborn, what was that based on? Are there previous cases or case law that established that there could not be? And so that's what I have three questions. That's one of them. Let's start right there.
So I think we have to trace back a little bit in our law. So going back to before 2008, there was a series of cases from across Canada. There's certainly not many of them, but there were some on what was at that time termed wrongful life, which was claims that were being made that but for the doctor's negligence, the child would not have been born at all, and now having been born with a disability should have the right to sue a doctor. And generally speaking, wrongful life claims were not recognized by our courts. And then in 2008, two cases went to the Court of Appeal for Ontario, Bovingdon and Hergett, and a case called Paxton and Ramsey. And both involved somewhat similar situations where the alleged negligence occurred before the conception of the child. And in both cases, there had been a full trial on the issues, and in both cases, the trial judge had found that a duty of care could and did exist to the unconceived and unborn child in those cases. And both of those cases went to the Court of Appeal for Ontario, and in both cases, the Court of Appeal found that no duty of care could be owed to the unconceived child in the circumstances of those cases. So what the Court of Appeal did was they said wrongful life doesn't add anything, that having a label for it isn't the way to approach these things. We have to go back to general principles of civil tort law to understand whether a claim should be recognized. And what they determined in both of those cases was that there was, because of the nature of the allegations in those cases, there would be an inevitable potential conflict between whatever duty the doctor in those cases owed to the mother versus the duty that the doctor was alleged to owe to the unborn and unconceived child. And in those circumstances, the Court of Appeal said, well, given that we can't, as a matter of public policy, essentially, we can't and shouldn't recognize the duty of care to the unconceived child because it would put a doctor in a potential position of conflict between the duty to their primary patient, the mother, and the duty to the unconceived child. And that's not a suitable mechanism. So that's the backdrop, I suppose, that existed when the Florence triplets claim came forward to the Court of Appeal or to the Motions Court as well. And what we tried to explain as best we could was, hang on a second. The circumstances are very different here than they were in those cases. And they're very different for one primary reason. And also a secondary reason. The primary reason is because given the nature of the allegation in this case, there could be no conflict between any duty owed to the unconceived child and any duty owed to the mother, because the duty was not to prescribe a contraindicated medication. And that duty is the same duty regardless, and therefore no conflict can exist. So if you take out the possibility of conflict, there really is no other legal basis for determining that no duty of care could be owed. The secondary reason, though, is something you alluded to, Chris, at the outset, which is the world is changing. technology is changing, and so too are our social constructs around that technology. More and more children are being born with the use of fertility medications and other assistive reproductive technologies. And to not have the law keep up with those changes creates a situation where more and more we're going to have the potential for injuries or harm where there is no remedy on existing law that predates those technological advances. And that's a real concern. One of the things we put forward to the Supreme Court of Canada when we sought leave is that in 2007, Canada signed on to the United Nations Convention on Children with Severe Disabilities. And it talks about the importance of recognizing autonomy and dignity and the rights and equal rights of all persons. But quite simply, the Florence triplets do not have the same rights, civilly speaking, that the rest of us have. And that's a concern.
So when you talk about the autonomy of the children, in a normal malpractice case involving an infant and a mother, the infant is a critical part of the lawsuit. Is that correct? Like the infant is, if there are damages awarded to the family, they are awarded to the infant's parents, but on behalf of the infant. Is that correct?
That is exactly right. And in fact, if we talk about the sort of labor and delivery context for a moment, if negligence occurs during the labor and delivery of a baby, the baby has a claim. And that has been well recognized, of course, by our courts. And after those two cases, Bovington and Paxton in 2008, that was challenged by the defense on the basis that those cases should be extended to say that even a child in utero during the labor and delivery process should not be owed a duty of care. And the Court of Appeal was very quick to say, no. They clearly are owed a duty of care. And you're quite right to raise that, because what that translates into when we talk about autonomy is, if in that context it's established that the doctor or nurse or other healthcare practitioner fell below the standard of care and caused injuries to the fetus during the labor and delivery process, who was then born alive and suffered damages, those damages actually belong to the child. They may have a litigation guardian who may be a parent or may not be. It could be a corporate guardian. It could be anybody. And those, whatever those damages are, they are there for the benefit, and they are owned by the child, even though they may need an intermediary because of the nature of their injuries. But in this context, that gets turned a bit on its head, because so the claim is now still going forward, of course. Dana and her husband Jared have claims, and those claims will proceed to trial. And our law has long recognized that a parent can claim for what's called the extraordinary costs of care of their child who has suffered a disability and therefore has extraordinary costs of care due to the negligence of a physician or other healthcare practitioner. So Dana Florence can make essentially the same claims in terms of the costs of care for the children that they would have been making on their own behalf had a duty been recognized to them. But any compensatory award in that regard belongs solely to Dana under that legal framework. And that's okay, I suppose, except it really is a question of the autonomy and individual civil rights of the children and who can control their destiny and future. And that, we say is an imperfect remedy where a perfect remedy was and is available and simply wasn't recognized by the court.
So is your concern if the money is the sole property of the parents versus the child and not necessarily designated for the upbringing and care of the children in this particular case, is there a concern, perhaps not in this case, but in other cases, that the money would not be used towards what it was intended to? Or is that the issue around autonomy that we're discussing here?
Well, I think, I think it's one of the issues. I think autonomy, you know, sort of encompasses a lot of concerns and a lot of, you know, the sort of individual well-being and rights of the children. But you're quite right. One of those concerns, and yes, it's not a concern in this case. These parents are devoted beyond anything one could ask and have done nothing but seek the betterment of life for their children, and I have no doubt will continue to do so. But to the extent that an award of damages is made to an individual, the reality is that individual has full control over those funds and can do with them what they please. As I say, there's no concern in this case in that regard. But could there be in another case? I absolutely think there could. And that creates the specter of a possibility of harm where one does not need to exist. We don't need to expose our system or children who have suffered significant injuries to that risk, where we don't, as I say, in any other context, if it's a labor and delivery context, for instance, there are specific safeguards that are put in place. Any funds awarded in those cases, as I say, they do belong to the children. They are required to be structured. There is a requirement of reporting through the Office of the Children's Lawyer up to the age of 18 and then the public guardian and trustee beyond that point on behalf of anyone who's managing funds on behalf of a disabled person. So we have all those safeguards in place, both in Ontario and in similar ways across the country, and for good reason, because what we're talking about is protecting the rights and well-being of the most vulnerable members of our society. And we've gone to great lengths to put in place processes that will ensure that that gets done. Yet, by not recognizing a claim in this context and leaving the claim as one that belongs to the parents, we've essentially in one fell swoop done away with all of those safeguards that we worked so hard to put in place. And that's a hard thing to understand from just a rational perspective, I think.
So I'm going to go back. I started with three questions a couple of minutes ago because I think it plays on exactly what you're talking about. You're talking about, you mentioned that Justice Fairburn had a dissenting opinion, and kind of, it sounds like, left a little tiny door open for future arguing of these cases or future success of, you know, allowing argument of these cases. Did Justice Fairburn, when he said we can't rule out all possibilities forever, that this, you know, that this isn't an issue, were there reasons offered for that? Like, was he forcing or suggesting that there was something about this case that could open a door down the road?
Yes. So let me correct one thing. Justice Fairburn is actually she.
Oh, geez. I'm sorry to Justice Fairburn. Sorry, Madam Justice Fairburn. Apologies.
And yeah, what she recognized. So again, I have to go back a little bit in terms of a history lesson to Bovington and Paxton. And it's important to understand what the factual matrix of those cases were in order to understand why this case was different and why Justice Fairburn said, wait a second, the appellants are right, this case is different and the door may well be open here. So in Bovington, interestingly, it was the same drug, it was Clomid. In this case, it was Seraphine, but as you rightly say, they're essentially the same drug. And in Bovington, the situation was mother had been prescribed Clomid, and she conceived of twins, and they were then delivered prematurely, and as a result of the prematurity, they suffered injury. So a lot, essentially exactly, it looks like on its face, exactly the same claim as the Florence triplets, except that they're triplets, and in Bovington, they were twins. But that's not... there was a fundamental distinction. In Bovington, the medication was properly indicated for mother. In other words, she had been attempting to conceive for over a year without success, which is the definition of primary infertility, and the medication was quite rightly recommended and prescribed to her. The claim was, mother said, I was not properly advised of the risk of multiples. And had I understood the true incidence of multiples, I would not have taken the medication. So that is what in law is, as you would know, referred to as an informed consent case. So it's not that the act itself was negligence. It was, you didn't give me proper information, material information, and had you given me the material information, I would have made a different decision. And in that case, when the case got to the Court of Appeal, they said, but wait a minute. If the duty that is being alleged to the children is the duty to give mom in the material information, mom could have got the material information and still decided to take the medication. And so you create this conflict because mother could have got the material information, still taken the medication, and the children, of course, would have no claim. They have no claim against mom. And how could the doctor owe them, therefore, a different level of duty when it comes to informed consent than the duty to mom, because in so doing, they could essentially override mom's consent, if that makes sense. That's not the claim here. The claim here is you never should have offered the medication. The medication was contraindicated. And that's what Justice Fairburn recognized as a truly defining issue. And no, I should back up. Justice Fairburn didn't decide that she would have recognized the duty of care to the children, only that they should have the right to go to a full trial and present full argument on all issues, including the issues of public policy, autonomy, etc., so that the court could actually make a reasoned decision about whether a duty of care should be recognized in this novel context, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. The other thing that you mentioned, well, I'm going to ask you the third part of my three-part question really quickly, because we're still on the same topic. When the Supreme Court denied to hear this case, did they offer reasons why?
They do not, and that's not isolated to this case. When a leave application is brought to the Supreme Court, it's a binary decision. They either grant leave or they dismiss leave, and that is literally the only thing they say. They either say leave granted or leave denied. And so it's not just in this case that they didn't offer reasons. They never do when it comes to that. And I can tell you that my heart sank when they give you notice of when the decision is coming out. And when I went on the website to look at it and saw that leave was denied, it was a tough day.
I think I talked to you that day.
I think you did.
Yeah.
You did. And it's long to still process it, but I'm getting there.
Yeah, I could tell. I can imagine it was a tough day. That's been a long road getting that far. And this is an important issue. I'm no judge or jury, and I don't know how it might ever go in the future. But it's a fascinating issue that I think this is not the end of it. You know, there's so many issues like this that are going to pop up. You know, I mentioned I was in Florida, and I happen to be, know some younger childbearing age women down here. And the talk about assisted reproductive technologies and IVF, it's just like, that's what we're all doing now. These are professional women who are waiting till their mid to late 30s to have a family. They want control over when, they want control over the sex, they want them all genetically tested before. And they all said, that's how we're all doing it. And I was like, wow, times in one generation, times have changed significantly around this issue.
Yeah. And you see, I mean, wide-ranging effects of that, both socially and legally. I mean, just to sort of on that point, there was a class action in Ottawa that was recently resolved. And it was a case, and I'm sure most people have read about it in the papers, it was a case where a fertility doctor who was running a fertility clinic was actually using some of his own DNA without knowledge of the patients. And, you know, of course, this comes to light. It's I'm sure, heartbreaking to the families, to the children who find out that they're not biologically who they thought they were. Now, there's a clear wrong there, of course, and doesn't need me to tell you that. But in approving the class action settlement, Justice McLeod in Ottawa made reference to this case. At that point, it was just the we hadn't sought leave at that point. Made reference to the case because there was a real question in resolving that class action about whether the children who were directly harmed by that action even had a right of action against the doctor. And that therefore affected how the settlement was arrived at and what was considered reasonable compensation for those children. So this is an issue that in a myriad of ways, some of which we can foresee and many of which we can't, is going to keep coming up.
Yeah. And how did that turn out? Was it determined that they had a cause for action in that particular case?
It was not determined. In fact, what he said in approving the resolution that was put in front of him was it's a fair and reasonable resolution when one recognizes that some of these claims, i.e. the claims of the children, may or may not actually exist as a matter of our law. So it puts their lawyers, it puts the court, it puts everyone in a really difficult position in order to understand what the rights of a certain group of people, and as you quite rightly say, a group of people who is likely to grow into the future and is growing now far more than, yes, it first arose 40 years ago. Now it's a significant percentage of the number of live births in Canada, and that's predicted to rise.
Yeah, it is predicted to rise. So we talked a little bit, or you mentioned kind of standard of care and consent issues. What were the standard of care?
Because of her of mother's age and stage, was contraindicated. And therefore, the very act of prescribing it fell below the standard of care required of the doctor. And of course, it's probably obvious that that claim has not been tried in a court because we haven't gotten to trial yet. But that's the allegation in the claim. And that in terms of standard of care, that's the primary issue that's going to go to trial now on behalf of Dana, but not on behalf of the children. She also has a claim for informed consent on the basis, what was she properly and effectively warned about the risk of twinning or multiples, and would that have affected her decision? But that's a claim that only exists for her. That claim never existed for the children because of the line of cases with Bovington. And what we were saying was, you have to understand, when it comes to a contraindicated medication, that's a whole different order of business. And one that does, it shouldn't matter who you're talking about, like where that duty of care is owed. The duty of care is owed to anyone that you could reasonably foresee would be harmed by your wrongful act of prescribing a dangerous and contraindicated medication.
And is the issue in this case that the prescribing caused harm or that the prescribing caused pregnancy, which resulted in harm? How are you approaching that argument?
So I smile. It's interesting you say that because, again, back into my history lesson, that was the sort of defining issue when claims before the Court of Appeal got a hold of Bovington and Paxton in 2008. And when we talk about wrongful life, what the courts were always wrestling with was did the medication cause the injuries or did it just cause the conception of the child? Because if it caused the injuries, the child should have a claim. But if it caused the conception and not the injuries, the child shouldn't have a claim. And what the Court of Appeal rightly said in Bovington and again in Paxton is you can't look at it that way. That doesn't help us. And the reason it doesn't help us is you could argue any drug, any issue on either side of that framework, right? You could say, well, no, the medication only caused the conception of the children. It didn't actually cause any birth defect or harm. Well, sure, that's one way of looking at it. Or you could say, well, the medication caused the conception of triplets, which caused the premature delivery, and therefore the drug actually did directly cause the harm. And you're never going to be able to resolve those two because they're both true. They just don't help you create a unified and predictable system of legal redress going forward. And therefore, as the Court of Appeal rightly said, that's not a useful framework. What we need to do is step back to basic principles of tort law and look at what does create a duty of care. And a duty of care exists where we know or should know that our act could foreseeably harm another. And if it's foreseeable that our act, our wrongful act, could harm someone, we owe that person a duty of care. Our law is dead clear on that. And what we say in this case is when you look at it on that principled and bedrock basis, there could be no question that the physician in prescribing fertility medications, of course, can foresee the children being conceived. That's exactly why the medication's being given. And of course, they could foresee the possibility of multiple gestation or multiple conception, because, again, that's the risk of the medication. And the risk with multiples is exactly what occurred here. So all of that is foreseeable. And there was no issue with foreseeability, either in Bovington or in this case, as we took it forward. The courts agreed that it was reasonably foreseeable they'd be injured. What they decided was there was no proximity between the physician and the unborn children, and that's where we had a fundamental disagreement.
So we have a lot of non-legal listeners, doctors and nurses in public. Could you explain what you just talked about there? There's no proximity between the physician and the children. Can you talk about that?
So again, going back to how our law looks at whether or not a duty of care should exist, it really looks at three things. It looks at, was it reasonably foreseeable? Was the person who was injured someone that was reasonably foreseeable to you, the potential defendant? The second thing is, was it proximate? Was there a close and direct relationship between the defendant and the person who was harmed? And the third thing is, if those two things are yes, are there public policy reasons that should argue against the recognition of a duty of care? Now, in most cases, we don't actually, all I do is medical negligence work, and we almost never talk about duty of care, because duty of care is well established in most contexts at this point, in both in medical circumstances, but across our society. But there are new and novel things that come up all the time where it needs to be addressed on those first level principles, and that's what we said here. So one of the arguments, of course, is, well, the child's unconceived. How could there be a direct and close relationship between a physician and a person who's not conceived? Well, if you think about that, we have no difficulty. And one of the examples in the academic literature on this is, take the example of a balcony collapsing. So an engineer negligently designs a balcony, and 10 years later, that balcony fails, as happened in Florida to an entire building not that long ago. And
I just drove by that building last week. It's shocking to see that. And now they've evacuated the building next door to it because there's issues going on.
And that's probably a great sort of example to use. Let's assume that that failure was the result of an engineering, a negligent engineering practice for a moment. And let's assume that that obviously people were injured and harmed by that, and they sued the engineer. And it was established that there was negligence in terms of how the building was designed or constructed. One wouldn't say that only people who had been born before the engineer designed the building can sue for that negligence. If you're born, because that was the date the negligence occurred, and if you weren't conceived by that date, you shouldn't be owed a duty of care. Of course, that's nonsense. If five people are on a balcony that collapses due to negligence, and three of them are 2 years old, they have the same civil rights as the other two who are on the balcony, no question about it. So what does that tell us? Does it tell us that our law should differentiate between the negligence of an engineer and that of a doctor. So engineers could be liable to anyone, whether conceived or not, who was foreseeably injured, but doctors can't. That seems to be an odd system of law. The way our system is set up and the way our law expands is not to carve out different classes of defendant or plaintiff. It's to carve out general principles that are applicable to all of us, no matter what we do, so that we have predictability and the right to claim where injury has occurred.
And how do you hope to bridge that gap of the differences in law and the gap between, you know, I'm thinking of thalidomide or a case like that where unborn children were directly damaged by a drug that was prescribed to the mother, but they were conceived at the time. You know, they'd been conceived. How do you hope to bridge that gap between the standard of care issues and the wrongful prescribing of a medication and the unconceived? It sounds to me like it's a tough journey. But I'm absolutely seeing your logic at the same time. I get it. And I have two parts of that question, but how, let's start with that one. How are you going to make that leap between the wrongful prescribing and the unconceived before life is yet started or conceived, I guess? There's a lot of language around that. I don't want to even get into that.
I think we've sort of already made that. So let me answer it two ways. First of all, I think we've already made that leap in all contexts, frankly, other than where the defendant is a physician. Okay. So I don't think that there's any, up until now anyway, has been any debate that, you know, go back to my engineering example of a balcony, that the engineer would owe a duty whether or not the person who was claiming was conceived at the date of the negligence. There'd be no question about that. I am concerned that in light of this case and the statements from the Court of Appeal that someone may now seek to argue, oh, wait a minute, if a defendant physician can't owe a duty to someone who's not conceived, I shouldn't have to owe a duty to them either. And we may get into a Pandora's box of reevaluating all of those legal principles. I think that's a possibility. Although I think, you know, realistically, the way these decisions have developed really is isolated to the context of medicine and the context of physician defendants. And that's part of where, you know, we have such a significant concern, is because, again, I keep going back to that's not how our law has ever developed, and nor is it how any principled system of law can develop. We can't start treating different classes of defendant or plaintiff differently, or we end up with a system of law that becomes unpredictable, unworkable, and then starts to get infused with value judgments, which may or may not reflect principle, if that makes any sense.
It does make sense, and it's interesting. And I want to open up like another Pandora's box that I can see from the healthcare perspective, which is fascinating. You know, we're just watching the nursing world right now, and a lot of the world is watching the recent trial of Radon DeVaught, who's a Nashville, Tennessee nurse who administered the wrong medication, which caused death, and it ended up a criminal charge. Jury found her guilty, and now the nurses here in the United States of America and around the world are watching for that, for her sentencing. And, you know, the biggest fear is if she's found guilty, are we all going to be guilty of a medication error? Could it be a criminal charge versus an act of negligence? And I don't know if my legal jargon is right there, but could we lose our job and go to jail for making medication error? How, like, if this case is ultimately successful down the road somewhere, because it's kind of interesting. I think you mentioned Bovingdon was in 2008. Is that correct?
Yes.
And here we are 14 years later. It's interesting, you know, the length of time it's been since this was challenged. And I wonder how long it will be again before a case similar to this comes up. But how could you see, if this case is ultimately successful, where a physician who prescribes fertility medications with the intent of pregnancy, and let's assume that consent is properly done and the mother is aware of, is fully aware of the risk of multiple pregnancies, how do you see that this could affect or change or mean for the providers of fertility medicine in the future?
Well, you know, that's one of the arguments that we were seeking to make, is that in a lot of ways, our tort system, one of the goals of the tort system, of course, is to compensate someone who suffered harm due to the wrongful act of another. That's the primary mechanism to achieve that end, and it's the primary goal of our civil justice system. But there's a very important secondary goal, which is behavior modification, right? It's about when courts pronounce on standards of care and what is required of any profession in any context, the goal of that is to adjust people's way of practicing in that area to increase patient safety, to protect the public, to make sure these things don't happen again. Well, if we don't recognize the rights of those who have been harmed by the act of another, then we're probably, at least arguably, not doing our very best job of adjusting a system to make sure that that harm is not repeated. That people, now, I should say, I take no issue. I mean, as I say, all I do is in medical cases, but I interact, therefore, with physicians and with nurses and hospital administrators on essentially a day-to-day basis. And they are a group of people who care very deeply about the rights and best interests of their patients. And I take nothing away from that. So even though the courts don't recognize or didn't recognize in this case that a duty of care should be owed to the unconceived, I have no doubt that most fertility physicians think very deeply about the rights of the future child when they make a decision or treatment recommendation to a mother or a family. But again, that should be first and foremost in their minds. In fact, it's legislated under the Assistive Reproduction Act that we do take the rights of the unconceived child into account, that we think about that. Well, our law should be reflecting that same thing. And given this decision, arguably anyway, it's not, or at least I would say it's not to the extent that it could.
Well, I think this case and the publicity around it and this podcast and the talking in the future discussions and articles on this are going to go a long way to inform the public as well. You know, I said I talked to lots of nurses. I talked to lots of, I have kids that are all childbearing age, so I know all of their friends. And the discussion around this is sometimes like, wouldn't it be fun to have twins or triplets? And my experience as an obstetrical nurse is like, no, especially when they're talking about fertility treatments. You know, maybe I'll just have two or three at once and get it over with. And I was like, no, the risks that come with that are significant. Even twins are definitely triplets. It's a high risk pregnancy at any time, but certainly when you've gone through fertility treatments, it's high risk as well. So I hope that's a message that's getting out too, that this isn't nothing, you know, to have assisted reproductive technologies and multiple pregnancies is it's no small thing, and it carries a lot of risk for both the patient and the babies, the mother and the babies. And this case is very much bringing that to light for the public as well, I think. Another question I have for you, we discussed a little bit about how these issues are forcing our legal system to modify, address, look at the unique challenges that are presented by assisted reproduction. And many would say, as a society, you know, we all have an obligation to be sure that this is implemented, might be the best word, in a socially responsible manner. And there's all sorts of issues around this, you know, how much to use these drugs, how many embryos to implant with IVF, what to do with embryos that aren't used. I mean, I know that there's a lot of frozen embryos out there, whether or not to do genetic testing, to use, you know, sex selection by choosing a boy or a girl. There's so many things that are going to come up, well, are already existing, but are going to come up in the future. In your view, I think the answer to this is no. Have the laws kept up with societal changes? But if not, what needs to happen from here?
Well, it's a great question, and I would say they haven't. The laws haven't kept up, and I say that because, again, we've got a class of people that have different rights than the rest of us, and that is problematic. And it's problematic, and it's emblematic of a change that's occurred because of those advances in technology. What needs to happen? Well, let me give you a simple example. When I talk about the importance of tort law, not just for compensating those who suffered harm, but for creating meaningful change to better protect the safety of the next patient comes along. The best example I can give you is years and years ago, there was a case called Anderson and Chasney. And it was a case, the original case, where during a surgery, and we're talking back in the 1950s here, they'd left sponges in the patient, and then closed the patient after an operation. The patient had gone on to suffer some pretty significant harm. And that case went to trial. And it went to trial, and the defense had experts who said, oh no, what the doctor did met the standard of care. Yes, it's unfortunate that sponges were left in the patient, but he did the surgery exactly how, you know, we train people to do the surgery, etc. And the trial judge said, wait a second. If that's the standard of care, then the standard of care is no good, because we're exposing people to harm and we should not be. There's got to be a better way of protecting them. And now, as you would know far better than I, Chris, we don't do surgeries with sponges other than, first of all, we do a full sponge count. Second of all, they're attached to strings that come out of the operating site so that this could never happen again. Is Anderson and Chasney the sole reason that all surgical sponges have a string and come out of the body so this couldn't happen? Probably not. But was it a driving force in causing the medical profession to step back and say, guys, we must do better. We can protect patient safety better than this, and this shines a spotlight on it. Answer, yeah, that does change the way we do things. So that to me is, it's one of the things that gets me up every morning and keeps me doing the cases I do, because I really firmly believe that aside from making sure that my clients' interests are protected and making sure that they do get the compensation they need to live a life of dignity and freedom and independence, no matter what the injuries they may have suffered, it's also about protecting patient safety in a broader sense. And that, I think, is one of the real fundamental drivers that tells me the courts need to look at this again and again until we really understand where we're at technologically and whether our law is actually keeping up with it.
So another question I have for you, and then I think we'll wrap this part of the podcast up, Duncan. I'm going to ask you two more questions. The first one is, what's next for this case?
What's next for this case is we will go to trial on behalf, because as I say, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, because it at least stops me from driving myself crazy, there is no higher level court in this country than the Supreme Court of Canada. When the Supreme Court denies leave, our clients' rights are at an end. I can't do anything further now to advocate on behalf of Cody Brody and Cole and Taylor than what we've already done, other than things like this, public statements about the importance of looking at this, the importance of understanding that these are people and they have needs and they're going to have needs going forward. And they allege, whether they're right or wrong, they allege that those needs arose because of the wrongful act of another, and they will never have their chance in a courtroom to face the person they accuse of causing them harm. So, you know, I think it is an issue that needs to be thought through and talked about, both from a tort perspective, also from a medical ethics perspective. In terms of what's next for the case, we will go to trial for Dana and her husband. And as I say, assuming we are successful on the fundamental questions of whether or not there was wrongful conduct by the physician, there will be an award of damages on behalf of Dana. As I say, that money will belong, to the extent that happens, that money will belong to Dana and her husband. I have, as I say, no question in my mind at all as to how that will benefit the children. It will fully benefit the children. And in this particular case, that will give them the means to live as independently and supported as possible. So that's sort of the next step. We don't yet have a trial date because of the nature of the duty of care arguments that had to go all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada, but I'm hopeful that we'll be at trial within the next 12 months or so. There's been a bit of a backlog here, as I'm sure there is everywhere due to COVID, but we will have a trial and those rights will be determined.
Well, thanks for fighting the fight. I mean, I have no doubt that this has been a long, long journey for you and the family so far. So all the best. There'll be a lot of people having eyes on this case to see how it turns out, me included. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about it today. I end every podcast with a question, and I just did two best of the best podcasts of the answers to this question, so I'm going to ask it to you. Because our podcast listeners include lawyers, doctors, nurses, and the general public, please answer this question for each one of those audiences. In your view, what is the most important thing that you would like doctors to know about medical malpractice? And you can put it in the context of this case if that's where your mind and your heart is right now. But that's the question. What's the most important thing you'd like doctors to know about medical malpractice law?
That's a great question. I think the thing I'd want them most to know, and hopefully they all do know, is most of the errors that lead to these cases are preventable. And with the forethought and looking at things and learning from our mistakes and realizing what we can do better, we can prevent harm. We can prevent these cases from ever arising. We can prevent people from suffering the significant injuries they do. Not always, of course, but a lot of what I see on a day-to-day basis, I have to tell you, Chris, it's the same errors that get repeated over and over again. And I think all of us having the ability to step back and the insight and the courage to look at what we've done or what others have done and say, what can we do to make sure that this doesn't happen again? And I think if we all took those steps, we'd all be better for it.
Great answer. I appreciate that you tossed courage in the mix, because that's certainly a big component of what it takes, courage to look at yourself in other cases. How would you answer that question for nurses? Would it be different if I said, what do you want nurses to know about medical malpractice?
No, although I'd repeat that word a lot of times. I think a lot of times it is about courage. It's about understanding that, and I've of course examined lots of nurses, I've seen lots of things happen, and I can't tell you the number of times I can tell just from looking at the records that a nurse understood what was happening or what might happen, and there was still a failure of communication and it still happened. And of course, I've never walked a mile in your shoes. I don't know that side of the equation near as well as you or any other nurse who's in the hospital day to day in the trenches. But having the courage to step up and say, wait a second, this shouldn't be happening right now. And the number of errors that are communication based, when you actually boil it right down, it was either a miscommunication or a failure to communicate between two or more people and most errors that I see, I got to be frank, they're not the result of one person making some egregious negligent error. It's the Swiss cheese model of fault, right? It took five or seven events all coming together in some weird way to create this loss. But each of those seven events, if someone stood back and said, wait, hang on a minute, power pause, let's think about this. It's one of the reasons, of course, that we instituted power pauses before surgeries, right? People realized you have to have that level of communication and that step back to say, what are we doing? Are we sure? Well, let's adopt and adapt that to every walk of life, and we'd be better off. So in my mind, nurses are the eyes and ears. They see a lot of stuff, and man, they know a lot of stuff. And I have the utmost respect for all of the nurses I've come in contact with over the last 30 years of my practice, in terms of their knowledge base and understanding and care of the patients that they're charged with the care for. But it's about stepping up and saying, no, hang on a second, let's look at this again. Did you see my nursing note? Do you understand what the vital signs were or what have you? I think that would change things dramatically.
That's another great answer. And I think you're right on communication. Like, statistically, 70%+ of medical errors have an element of miscommunication, wrong communication, late communication, minimal communication attached to them. So well said. What advice do you have to offer for the general public? What would you like the public to know about malpractice?
Ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Because again, when we talk about communication, that also is a two-way street. The patient or their family can really change the level of safety by asking those questions, making sure, like, you know, did you mean to change my medication? Did you, you know, and a lot of times I think people are afraid to ask questions of their doctors. And I know doctors are busy and nurses are busy. Lord knows, especially now, the system is stretched to its limit. But taking that time can save so much heartache, and it can be done in a respectful and a patient way. And I think if people really took that to heart and said, you know, I want to understand my medical condition, I have questions, please help me. That would go a long way. And I guess the other thing I'd say is, I think a lot of people approach the system from a place of lack of familiarity and lack of understanding. And I know I see a lot of cases, a great number of cases, where English is a second language to my clients. And empowering them, and I know most hospitals, if not all of them, have translator policies in place, but it can be very difficult to have an interpreter present for each discussion. And I know lots of people feel, boy, my English isn't very good, I better just nod my head and smile. And no, speak up, and if you don't understand, tell somebody.
Those are two great pieces of advice as well. As a nurse, even, I'm always in awe when I walk into a room and I'll hand a patient a handful of pills and they just take them. I would never do that in 1,000 years. I would pick every single thing apart and ask questions about everyone. And my family still gets me about that. If they say, here, taste this, even if it's a bite of their spaghetti, like, there's no way I'm going to put that in my mouth until I've had a good look at it to be sure I know what it is. So that's your specific example about asking about medications is a great one. And I don't know a nurse who hasn't made a medication error. I don't know a single nurse who hasn't made a medication error. So I certainly would have appreciated that moment if someone said to me, hey, what are you doing there? What are you giving me? I would have appreciated that as a nurse. Like, please ask me if it seems wrong. So that's good. And what would you like, you're at the top of your game at this point in your career, Duncan. What would you like other lawyers, maybe upstarts or up and coming or people who dabble a bit in malpractice, what would you like other lawyers to know about medical malpractice law?
Make sure that you do your homework and understand the underlying medicine involved in the situation. Understand it completely before you run off and start a claim or tell a family what you can do for them, because there is nothing worse than putting someone or their family through 3, 4, 5 years of litigation where it shouldn't exist. And you know, sometimes terrible events happen to people in the medical system, just like terrible events happen to people in other systems. And it doesn't mean that someone fell below the standard of care, and it doesn't mean that there's a viable basis to seek compensation for it. So it's, you know, I get asked to look at a lot of cases. I get asked to take over a lot of cases where someone has erroneously thought that because an injury occurred in the hospital, therefore someone must have screwed up. Not the case. So I think understanding that and really approaching things, listen to what your clients have to tell you, review the medicals, but understand the medicine. And if you don't, make sure you find people who truly do in terms of experts. I mean, and I know you've done podcasts with others before who talk about the expert selection process. I'm a big believer in I don't hire people who agree with me or tell me what I want to hear and tell me I have a case. I'm not interested in an echo chamber. What I'm interested in is someone who spends their life doing this medicine, whatever it may be, in the trenches at the top of their game, who can give me an honest, objective, neutral, and impartial opinion about whether or not this injury was preventable. If the answer is yes, I will go to the end for my clients. If the answer is no, they should know that as soon as possible so that they can move on with their life without false hope, without anything else. Because this process is, it's invasive, it's costly, it takes everything from a family, but also from the physicians and nurses on the other side. It's a heck of a thing when you go out and make allegations against someone that they've fallen below the standard of care, and I don't take that lightly. And I think making sure that that's done ahead of time and with a full understanding is critical to what we do.
Very well said. I like that you said that it's a heck of a thing for the doctors and nurses too, because it is. And I've talked about that on other podcasts. What a heck of a thing it is for healthcare too. So it's not a pretty process for anyone. So that's really great advice to lawyers listening in, to really do your own work on this, to be sure. And I'm always in awe of your medical knowledge, Duncan, I have to tell you. Like, I think, you know, the good medical malpractice lawyers do an exceptional job of boning up on the medicine. And I learn things from lawyers all the time, to be honest, because you go so deep into so many things. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us before we sign off?
No, I think other than thanking you for giving me the opportunity to speak about an issue that I have a real belief in, and I thank you for it.
Yeah, you're welcome. I want to thank you for your hard work again, like I said, and your passion around this case, and for your honest and open discussion of this incredibly fascinating case, which I'm sure we haven't heard the end of it. It's been a pleasure, and I have no doubt that everyone listening has something new to think about, to consider, to ponder, to get mad about, to argue about, like all controversial topics do. So thank you so much, Duncan, and thank you for everyone who listened in. Goodbye, and take good care.